From the land to Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 20th day of April, 2023. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason in Washington this week with the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. Today, we'll hear some policy insights from an individual that's been involved in the legislative process for 9 farm bills. And then we'll talk with the U.S. Grains Council about some work that was done on the University of Illinois campus related to starch, the export market, wet milling, and profitability. And we'll do all of that right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We'll begin today by hearing an excerpt from a presentation made to the National Association of Farm Broadcasting on Tuesday of this week by Randy Russell. He's the CEO, president of the Russell Group, and has been involved in 9 different farm bill debates. In fact, I think he'd prefer to call this a farm and feeding program, though he didn't quite use those words. It's really interesting to listen to him about the debate and what he thinks will take place this year.
One of the things I found from those 9 farm bills is that there are 3 factors that drive the outcome of farm bills. It is the farm economic environment at the time the farm bill is written. It is the budget environment at the time the bill is written. And what's the political situation? So let me make a couple of comments about each one of those and then jump into a couple of key issues and then take some questions you might have. First of all, let's look at the state of the farm economy. If you go back to 2002, if you look at net cash income, the average net cash income is $127 billion, according to USDA, going back to 2002. In 2022, we had net cash income of $199 billion. I mean, it was a record level. This year at the Outlook Conference, Seth Meyer and others at USDA predicting that we're at about $150 billion for net cash income. While down considerably, 17% from the year before, still well above what we would say over the last 20 or 21 years. The debt-to-asset ratio for agriculture is somewhere in the neighborhood of 13%. When I was chief of staff at USDA for Secretary Block back in the mid-80s, debt-to-asset ratio was 22%. Remember back then, farm equity values dropped by a third. The farm credit system needed a bailout. By the way, they paid back the loan and paid it back in full and paid it back before it was due. But nonetheless, very difficult time. So the balance sheet for ag, much better, obviously, than historical averages. So that's a little bit of the economic on the political situation. Just a couple of quick comments. Most evenly divided Congress in the history of this country. Can I repeat that? The most evenly divided Congress in the history of this country. So passing a Mother's Day resolution would be difficult. Trying to pass a farm bill in this environment is going to be very difficult. And I'll comment a little bit about that in just a second. Let's start with the House. 5-seat advantage for Republicans. You look at the House Agriculture Committee, you're going to have G.T. Thompson, I know, speak to you, I believe, tomorrow. And the task he faces is pretty daunting. Why do I say that? I say that because you look at the 54 members of the House Agriculture Committee, 16 of them voted on the 2018 Farm Bill. 16 out of 54. 20 freshmen on the committee. Now, I'm not passing any judgment about that. I'm just simply saying that the education job for a chair and a ranking member to try to get a farm bill through in this environment is daunting. All of us are in the advocacy business. Mary Kay Thatcher, many, many other people that are in the advocacy business, we have a very difficult environment to deal because we have to educate, educate, educate because there are so many new members and so much new staff. Also remember, in the House of Representatives, it takes 218 votes to pass a farm bill. 35 members represent districts that are primarily rural. 35 out of 435. Now, I'm not the smartest damn person in the whole world, but I know in order to get to 218, it means you need well over 180 members from suburbia and urban areas. Do you understand why we have nutrition as part of the Farm Bill? At least we forget that. Over in the Senate, it's a little bit better numbers in terms of member continuity. 16 of the 23 voted on the 2018 Farm Bill. But still, quite a few new members and new staff. So that is the environment that G.T. Thompson faces, that Debbie Stabenow faces, David Scott faces, and John Bozeman face. Now, what about the budget situation? Obviously, this is going to be front and center. You take the 2018 Farm Bill, and you take the 10-year cost of the 2018 Farm Bill, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, the unbiased congressional scorecard, so to speak, for budgeting, $867 billion. Okay? 76% of the cost of that, nutrition programs, primarily SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly food stamps. You take now the 2023 Farm Bill, extended for 10 years, that cost goes from $867 billion to $1.5 trillion. That is with a T. Even in Washington, that is a big number. $1.5 trillion, 82% of that is in SNAP or food assistance programs. If the FDA were going to investigate the term Farm Bill, it would find that it was in violation, saying it is untruthful and very misleading. 82% of the cost of the Farm Bill is in nutrition programs. 18% in the broadest sense, Title I, farm programs, conservation programs, trade and export programs, research programs, animal disease control programs, energy programs, crop insurance, that's included in the 18%. So again, we call this a farm bill, but in reality, it is a nutrition bill that happens to have farm provisions in it, and I think we all need to recognize that and understand that. So obviously that's gotten a lot of attention. We have a debt ceiling vote that has to come up sometime. No one knows exactly when, but I suspect it'll be maybe before the August recess. You can ask the members themselves tomorrow. They'll be gone the whole month of August. So I would suspect they'll probably have to vote on it sometime in July. We heard Speaker McCarthy yesterday at the New York Stock Exchange lay out his plan. He made it very clear that there has to be some budget adjustments. It will not be just a clean debt ceiling increase. So we'll have to watch this debate. It will be virtually impossible for the ag committees to mark up their bills without having dealt with the debt ceiling. So that's got to come first, and that's going to have to be dealt with. That's going to therefore delay the markup of the Farm Bill in both the House and Senate Agriculture Committees. Finally, let me just comment on a couple of issues, then I'd be glad to answer any questions you have. You know, we've got several issues that are going to be dealt with in this Farm Bill. One, obviously, is will there be changes to the nutrition program? Will there be any adjustments made on the SNAP program? And I suspect that you're going to see the House push pretty hard on the work requirements. I think that's going to be a theme you're going to see throughout, not just on the SNAP program, but on other government assistance program for low-income Americans. So keep your eye on that, particularly the so-called ABOD, able-bodied adults without dependents between the ages of 18 and, let's say, 50. I think you're going to see some efforts to try to tighten the work requirements. Some people in the Senate may not agree with that approach, and we'll have to see where that all works out. But that clearly will be front and center. Another issue will be on Title I will be the so-called reference prices for some of the key commodities. The challenge with that is the cost, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And when you ask the members tomorrow, you look at about a 10% increase in the reference prices for some of our key commodities, and I think the Congressional Budget Office says that'll cost about $20 billion. So that will be a challenge. Yes, is there a need to look at these reference prices where they were set versus where cash prices are today? But the challenge will be, how will the Congressional Budget Office score that? Another area will be the funding in the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, that was put into the four major conservation programs, the cost share funds and et cetera, that was put in to incent growers to adopt climate smart ag practices. And it was $20 billion, about 17 or 18 billion of that was put into EQIP, Conservation Stewardship Program, the Environmental Conservation Easement Program, and the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. I think you'll see an effort made possibly to take some of that money and put it in to other purposes. I also want to remind folks that money, while it was passed as part of a budget reconciliation bill, only with Democrat votes, does go directly to producers in the form of adopting climate smart practices on their farming operations. So watch that very closely. And then finally, I think you're going to see a theme in this farm bill, which is food security is national security. And we've heard a lot about that, but I think in light of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the disruptions to the supply chain, not just on sunflowers and wheat and some of the grain trade that was obviously impacted, but also on fertilizer and others, other supply chains that were disrupted. Also with what's going on relative to China, I think you're going to see much more of a focus on ensuring that we have our own supply chains in line, looking forward to other potential conflicts that may come our way down the road.
That's Randy Russell. He's the president of the Russell Group. We're here in Washington, D.C. with the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. We'll continue the program from willag.org in a moment.
Kerry Sifrath, the vice president of the U.S. Grains Council.
You've been working with some researchers on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, VGA Singh, who's done a lot of work over the decades related to biofuels production, ethanol, and other sorts of starches. And you've been working with him related to the origin of the starch. Can you tell me a little bit about that work, please?
Yeah, sure. And Dr. Vijay Singh, he's been working with the Grain Council maybe 20 years or more. Especially as we target the wet milling, the cornstarch and sweetener industry sector around the world. But yeah, here lately, the last couple of years, we've had a program where we look at what is the starch yield from U.S. corn versus some of our competitors around the world, whether that's Brazilian, Argentine. We even did a little work against Ukrainian corn and showing the so that even if U.S. corn is a higher price than our competitors, the starch yield you get out of your wet milling plant in Egypt or in Colombia or in Korea and Indonesia, we actually are getting a higher starch yield to easily pay for the higher price of U.S. corn to try and show those sectors around the world, those corn wet millers around the world, that U.S. corn is giving you a better value in the starch yield. And depending on how much corn you're running through your plants, can be anywhere from $100,000 to several million dollars advantage by using U.S. corn over some of our competitors. And Dr. Singh has been in the height of that. We started with, you know, just doing some sample size runs in his lab back in the University of Illinois, to doing some larger runs at actual ethanol or corn wet milling plants around the world. And now we've had Dr. Singh around the world actually explaining and meeting with these wet milling companies. He was just down in Colombia a couple of weeks ago. We'll be having a cornstarch conference in Seoul, South Korea, where we're bringing cornstarch millers from around the world and to hear the results of Dr. Singh's work that he's done with the Grain Council over the last couple of years.
A couple of notes. There is a building on campus, which Dr. Vijay Singh mostly operates out of, that is able to produce small batches of wet milling and other dry milling and other kinds of things, so that those who have ideas can come in and say, will this work? What's the science behind it?
Clearly, the U.S. Grains Council has done that for quite some time. What are the components of the wet milling process at the end, and how are they used?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit different than the dry grind, the typical dry grind ethanol production you see here in the U.S. Wet milling is where you're basically soaking the corn in a water and sulfuric acid combination to break down that corn. That's why it's called wet milling. And then you take that, and after the corn, it's what they call steeped or kind of soaking. So here in the U.S., they do it about 24 hours. Other places around the world might do 36 or 48 hours. But then that allows you to break that corn apart into different components, the germ where all the oil is, separate out the starch and the oil and the fiber through centrifuges, basically. And then that's where you get your corn starch. It's where you get your corn gluten feed, the fiber portion of it. So you get your corn gluten meal, the protein part of it. And so basically a way of segregating that kernel of corn out for different uses. Now that I have corn starch, there are lots of uses for just plain corn starch, but I can turn that into dextrose. I can turn that into different corn sweeteners and lots of other food and industrial products that can be used, that corn starch can be a big part of, from the glossy covers on the magazines and other paper pamphlets you may see, to lots of processed food products that have corn starch as a binder or other things in. So it's the use of it is quite large and quite expanding.
So when the U.S. Grains Council had VJ look at these different origins, you were hopeful that there would be higher starch or some differentiation. Did you think it would actually show that?
We've had some, the corn wet millers in Japan have favored using U.S. corn for decades now because they were seeing that internally. We wanted to go and put together our own numbers to do that. And the key to this is we didn't just go down the road, have VJ drive down the road 20 miles and pull some U.S. corn from a corn bin. We took, just like the Brazilian and Argentine and Ukrainian corn, even the U.S. corn, came after it was loaded and shipped to Colombia or Egypt to an international destination and collected it. So we have a sample of what U.S. corn is like when it arrives at a country of destination country to really compare that Brazilian and other competitors to the same, rather than just having VJ drive 20 miles down the road and get some corn from a farmer there in Illinois.
Is it working? Are people on the other end in other countries saying, yes, we think we can make this work?
Yes, we're seeing that, and we're going out and giving that message. We're seeing in certain markets, even the cornstarch companies in Indonesia are starting to see that and asking for U.S. corn. And it's going to take us a while to continue to get that message out. And that's why we're having this big cornstarch conference in May in Seoul, South Korea. Really to help create a differentiation between U.S. corn and our competitors, and showing, that 3% or 2% increased starch yield has a value to it, so that people don't just look at, well, I can buy Brazilian corn for $3 a ton less or Argentine corn for $5 a ton less. There's actually a cost at the end of the corn starch processing that tells you you're actually better off paying that slightly higher price for U.S. corn, and or if we happen to be equal to or lower, or even a better value at the end of the day.
Switch topics for just a moment, and we'll wrap up. I do want to talk about GMOs, Mexico, and the United States. This is a battle that's ongoing. It looks like a battle that has been mostly political in nature. Where does the U.S. Grains Council stand on this? Will it be settled? Will the United States still be able to ship mostly by rail car into Mexico, number two, yellow corn?
Well, President AMLO, he put out a new decree back on February 13th, which basically was targeting only white corn for food use or human consumption use in Mexico, and is allowing yellow corn for feed use and for that corn starch sweetener industry in Mexico to continue until they can find a substitute, which not sure how they'll do it or how long that'll take, but so at least for now, yellow corn continues to flow. And, you know, in early March, USTR asked for consultations under the SBS chapter of USMCA as trying to say, you know, where's your safety assessment that allows you to say these GM events are okay in this type of corn, but not in that type of corn. And that's really what the U.S. Grain Council, USTR, USDA, other players in it, in the market are really looking at, because we can't allow that kind of differential to say it's safe here, but it's not safe there. And so those, you know, that consultation, we're past the 30-day mark. Nothing that says USTR cannot continue consultations beyond that. And that seems to be what's going on now. We'll have to see where they go and how that goes, and whether what USTR's next step will be. But, you know, yellow corn continues to flow to Mexico on a regular basis, and we don't see anything stopping that. We'll have to see how the white corn side of things plays out going forward. But Mexico's also then is banning exports of their white corn. We do see at times Mexico exporting some of their white corn, especially in that kind of southwest corner where they produce a lot, you know, neighboring countries, Honduras, Colombia, and then importing U.S. white corn into the Yucatan area. Now shutting down those exports, I think they're trying to move that domestically. Their rail system isn't really set up to move corn across the country that way. It's more north and south. So if they do that, they're going to have white corn arriving in Yucatan at a much higher price than what we could deliver it from the U.S. And so that may even start to affect tortilla prices in Mexico, which may be at some point the tumbling factor in all this. In the meantime, we'll see how USTR moves forward on their consultations with Mexico, which Canada, the day after the U.S. announced, also joined in. And so you have, you know, two of the three, both U.S. and Canada having consultations with Mexico, because Canada as well does not want to see, you know, a precedent set that saying these things are unsafe without any kind of risk assessment or scientific proof of that. Just, you know, the political nature of wanting to not have these products in our country is not within the USMCA is not allowed.
Thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
Sure, anytime, Todd. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Kerry Sifferath is with the U.S. Grains Council. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find our programs online. Listen to them on demand anytime you'd like. You can do that at willag.org, willag.org, or look us up in your favorite podcast applications, places like Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and many, many more. The Closing Market Report theme music is written, performed, and produced by Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you this week from Washington, D.C.